Good evening. Welcome to the Solarity Report. Today is Thursday, June 4th, 2009. I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and I'm delighted you could join me this evening. Tonight, we're going to review the top stories in money and markets. I got one quick, great question and ask Catherine. And then we're going to talk about how to find a great local bank with two wonderful bankers who happen to be my bankers. And then we're going to talk about Max Stout, which is an excellent documentary. And I hope you had a chance to watch it before this evening. But if you didn't, I really recommend it. It's just marvelous and just a perfect example of one of the great documentaries in this explosion of more and more documentaries that we've been getting for the last 10 or 15 years. Anyway, money and markets. Our theme tonight is financial musical chairs intensifies. And the sub-theme is that as it intensifies, the contrast between sort of what I call the real deal, what's really going on, and the various distractions grow. First off, the pain in the economy continues to grow. Unemployment is now approaching 7 million. Alan Abelson and Barron's last weekend predicted it's going to grow to over 10% next year. And those are the official statistics. And we've talked about the difference between that and what you'll see at some wonderful sources like ShadowStats, ShadowStats.com. Foreclosures, let me just read you one release from the Center for Responsible Lending. Foreclosure starts, the first step of an often lengthy process, already hit the 1 million mark this year. The group, according to estimates from the Center for Responsible Lending, the group expects foreclosure starts to hit 2.4 million in 2009, reducing property values of 70 million households by approximately half a trillion dollars, or $7,200 per family. At the same time, we see bankruptcy filings rising to 6,000 a day. According to USA Today, let me just read it, consumer and commercial bankruptcy filings are on pace to reach 1.5 million this year, according to a report from Automated Access to Court Electronic Records. While well below the record 2 million filings in 2005, the number of filings is up sharply from last year's 1.1 million. So quite a lot of pain. The GM filed, of course, one of the biggest bankruptcies in the history of the United States. GM filed for bankruptcy as expected. There was a happy face put on it. Cisco replaced General Motors in the Dow, giving a sense of the new economy emerging. Press releases about how we're going to green the Rust Belt. What was ignored was a great story from Greg Palast, which you'll find up on the blog, about the extraordinary precedent of stripping out retiree health care as part of the bankruptcy deal, while some of the senior banks are getting paid off in full is the indication. So what you're watching is a very big step in a process of deindustrialization that we saw start in the late 80s. And we've talked and I've written about it before. If you really want to see more about the deindustrialization story, I would recommend, if you haven't, to get copies of the DVDs of the TV show Wired. It's set in Baltimore, and you really see the policy decisions and the political decisions coming down from on high to deindustrialize the economy. It's extraordinary. And what's interesting is if you look at the capital that got pulled out of this country in the 90s, particularly when the dollar was high and Asia collapsed, what we're now going to start seeing is GM downsizes and Chrysler downsizes, and we see a whole series of shutting of manufacturing capacity. What we're now going to see is money was pulled out, reinvested, including in Asian car companies. That money is going to be used for those Asian car companies to come in and take a much bigger piece of the market share, so expect that to happen. One of the most extraordinary disinformation stories of the week was congressional expenses. We've been watching in the UK for about 6 weeks now explosion of stories of scandal about MPs' personal expenses, MPs being the UK equivalent of or their legislators. Now we're watching the same thing happen here. On the weekend, Saturday, Sunday, Wall Street Journal, May 30th, we see headlines lawmakers billed taxpayers for TVs. And there on the front page of the Wall Street Journal, we are regaled with stories mentioning, are you ready for this? Ohio Representative Michael Turner expensed a $1,425 digital camera, and the House delegate from America Samoa charged two 46-inch Sony TVs. Now, let's see what's not on the front page of the Wall Street Journal. What's not on the front page of the Wall Street Journal is the fact that the Fed Inspector General, you know, when you saw the video on the blog, admitted that they had no idea where the $7 trillion of loans on the Fed balance sheet went. There's no mention of the inability of Treasury to track where trillions in bailout funds went. There's no mention of the fact that the U.S. government has yet to produce audited financial statements, but instead we're focusing on a $1,425 purchase of a digital camera by Ohio Representative Michael Turner. Now, you saw this at the end of the last housing bubble bust. You have incredible sort of phony scandals about petty things, the theory being most Americans can relate to, you know, overexpenditure on a TV or a camera, whereas they can't relate to $7 trillion on the Fed balance sheet. Now, it gets worse. On the Thursday Wall Street cover page, we show the UK Prime Minister fighting for his survival. Now, usually when you have a picture in a major corporate media outlet that says so-and-so fighting for their survival, that's designed to make it more likely that they don't survive. It's designed to kind of build what I call the swarm against them. And another article announcing that the House lifts the lid on its expenses, and the House has now agreed that they will post representative expense reports online. Now, here's what's so amazing about this. I was part of a group of people that spent years trying to persuade and argue that the U.S. government should post its contracting budgets online and all sorts of information online, which is it has refused to do. So the fact that the House is putting up really what amounts to trivial amounts of money is extraordinary. Now, what typically happens in a situation like this is Congress stops governing and starts defending itself or starts walking around on eggshells. My guess is you have several things converging at the same time. The first thing, and probably most important, is that we now have a deficit projected to be $1.8 trillion. What this means is the primary dealers, which are the banks and investment banks who are responsible to finance the government deficit, are now faced with monthly auctions and weekly auctions in dramatic increases of what they've had to handle in the, you know, in recent years, if ever. And so there's a lot of fear about how that's going to happen and what that's going to do to interest rates and what interest rates are going to do to the financial strength of all sorts of different people, from households to companies to banks. So that's number one. Number two, we've seen Ron Paul's bill requesting transparency in the Fed getting more and more sponsors. Alan, Representative Grayson's grilling of the Fed Inspector General and other aspects of the Fed. And believe it or not, it's unbelievable, we have the German Chancellor now blasting the powers of the Fed, and not just the Fed, but England's Central Bank and the European Central Bank. So it wasn't just the Anglo-American line; it was all the central banks. So you see a lot more sort of visible opposition and questioning of the central banks. Third, the New York Fed member banks are on much more solid ground. They've gone out, they've raised a lot of capital, they've consolidated, and so they're feeling a little bit more comfortable. Now, what was the big thing that happened this week? What I would say is it was Bernanke's testimony, and here's why, and you really have to read in between the lines. He says, let me read it to you. Federal Reserve Chairman warned on Wednesday that rising U.S. debt was contributing to a spike in longer-term interest rates. That's true of the bond market. Is off rates up a bit, particularly in the long treasury market, and said now is the time to start working on reining in the government debt. He gave no clue as to whether the U.S. Central Bank would step on its purchases, step up its purchases of government debt or mortgage-backed securities to offset rates, something investors have been watching for. Maintaining the confidence of the financial markets requires that we as a nation begin planning now for the restoration of fiscal balance. So now that we've bailed out the banks, we need the restoration of fiscal balance. He then proceeds to that the way this needs to be done is to pare back entitlement programs. What that means is Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security. So what we've been watching in the economy is the Fed inflating, basically expanding the monetary money supply rapidly to help stabilize the bank and the financial sector. And they've been offsetting the inflationary effect of that with what's called demand destruction, which is unemployment, foreclosures, a drop in all sorts of different kinds of economic activity. And what you're watching is a fundamental restructuring of the relationship between labor and capital and a fundamental restructuring of the New Deal and the social safety network. Now, what's interesting is if you look at the politics of this, the latest polls show that President Obama enjoys a 65% approval rating from the Democratic side, 35% approval rating from the Republican side. What that means with the Democratic majority in the Congress and with that kind of approval rating, you now have the political and financial conditions set to do that kind of fundamental reengineering. And I think that's probably one of the reasons you're seeing an effort to chop the legs out from under Congress. My prediction is we've just finished the Bilderberger meeting in May. We know that there was great debate about how to handle the problems in the economy globally in the United States as well. We're coming into a G8 meeting in early July. We're watching all sorts of international deals go down behind the scenes, and we've got the Bohemian Grove meeting in mid to early August. And my expectation is we're going to see a slow and steady shift as we re-engineer the social contract to the importance of having to do that because of the demands of international lenders and international groups. It's almost, you know, I used to do a lot of babysitting, and I can hear in my head, "Mommy, Mommy, the IMF made me do it," but that's what's going to happen. You know, under the circumstances, if you see your congressman, you know, and I live in a place where you do see your congressman, you want to tell them how glad you are that they have a nice expense account and insist that they keep demanding equivalent transparency from the Treasury and the Fed. Anyway, the bottom line is the pressure on the dollar is there. Now, the dollar's had an incredible rally. If it's been off this last week, it's off from a place that's much higher, you know, than the lows we've seen in the last couple of years. We have Bill Gross of PIMCO warning people to get out of the dollar before the sovereign wealth funds and the central banks do. That's awfully strange because if you look at his company and their investors, I would say that there's a deep conflict of interest. He's put a lot of people in the dollar. I'm surprised he's out there saying it. It kind of leaves a question mark in your mind. More disturbing, though, is we saw the Secretary of the Treasury give a speech at Peking University, where he studied in the 1980s, telling the audience that China's money is safe invested in dollar assets, and we have the students laughing. So it's an extraordinary situation when you have Chinese college students simply breaking up laughing at the thought that China's money and would be safe in the United States Treasury. So it's not a good sign. Now, a second thing that's going on as you watch all of this happening, and it's a very important trend to see under the headline or under the carpet, if you will, is we're watching a relocalization of capital. We've had capital dramatically move into the financial centers and into the financial intermediaries, and as the economy shrinks, there's a war going on as a lot of that capital starts to relocalize. A very important story. We saw Ecuador demanding that capital come back to Ecuador to help keep the economy going. And it's a perfect example of somebody saying, wait, you know, I've got to pull the blood back to the heart and lungs. I can't keep sending it, shipping it out of here. And my prediction is, we also, Rob Kirby had a story about gold transfers. We're seeing a lot of noise about different kinds of transfers of assets and deals behind the scenes, sovereign wealth funds and sovereign governments. And I think that's all part of this pressure to decentralize. Now, normally in a global economy, if you have these kinds of pressures, the way they're determined is with price. Interest rates rise. Ecuador needs capital, so it raises interest rates and capital flows in. We're not seeing that kind of market settling of supply and demand. We're seeing, you know, we're seeing rules and we're seeing rigging and we're seeing the kind of squabbling where the German, we literally see the head of Germany coming out and blasting the central bank. So there's all sorts of dynamic squabbling going on, and that's why my theme is musical chairs, because we've had this unrealistic explosion of financial paper, and it's all now trying to reconcile to the reality of you know, how do you reconcile that paper to real assets? And so, you know, that tension and that sort of squabbling is playing out internationally. It's playing out at the local, state, and federal government level here. It's playing out in your community. So this is a dynamic we're going to see throughout our lives, and we're going to see it for some period of time. Okay, so one of our favorite things to say in financial permaculture is the problem is the opportunity. So where is the opportunity in all of this? The opportunity is there's going to be more and more freedom to change and do things that many of us have wanted to do at a local level but really haven't been able to do. In the last 2 weeks, I've seen more entrepreneurial positive spirit, excitement, interest in all sorts of local activities. You know, it's almost a pioneer spirit. It's kind of like, well, I guess that's over. Now we're free to rock and roll and do something new. And part of it is, as I've spoken before, there's a lot of talent breaking free that's now available to do, you know, to do either new kinds of things like clean technology or what's going on in your local area. And now, it's very important, and one thing I really encourage you, I'll never forget, 2000, I have this wonderful neighbor here in Hickory Valley, and she walked up to me and she said, I think we need to plan on not having Social Security, Medicaid, and Medicare. And she said, I'm not saying we're not going to have it, I just want to stop worrying about it. And I thought that was great advice, because what we're going to see in the healthcare debates and in the, you know, and in the federal credit and balance the budget kind of debates is we're just going to see all sorts of yakety yak and ya ya about both the cost of healthcare and Social Security. And so I think it's really important to be able to move through, navigate that whole process without fear. And so start thinking now, okay, how would I do it if all of that stuff just became too difficult, too tricky, too expensive, too hard, or, you know, or something? Or if we get hyperinflation, you know, I continue to get it, but the purchasing power is rapidly diminished, because the social contract is fraying, and I think it's really incumbent on all of us to make other plans if we can. Okay, now one of the things I wanted to mention, there's been extraordinary activity in the precious metals market, and we're going to talk about that with Franklin Sanders next week. But one thing I just had to note, Northwestern Mutual, which is one of the third largest insurance companies in America, which is the third largest insurance company in America, just announced that they purchased $400 million of gold. I was stunned. It's a little bit like, it's the financial equivalent, or I should say it's the wholesale market financial equivalent of Michelle Obama wearing J. Crew. You know, it puts the real stamp of approval on gold. And so I questioned on the blog whether it was real gold or paper gold, and sure enough, later reports have been confirming that it's real gold. I haven't been able to get that on Northwestern Mutual's website, but that is a remarkable development. But we'll talk about it more next week with Franklin. And then we were going to do Navigating Economic Warfare on June 18th, but I'm moving that back into July. I want to do on June 18th something called California Budget Crisis. Yikes, what can I do? We're going to focus on California, but I'm going to, what I want to talk about is if you are an individual, if you're a family, if you have a network of friends in California or are involved in your community, what can you start to do now to adapt to the situation? California has a $22 billion budget, yes, but in fact, if you look at all of the different assumptions and all of the different rules and regulations behind that deficit, in fact, if you start to change how things are done, there's tremendous opportunity to really build community and to build community equity, but it's going to take some digging and some work, and so I really want to create something that initially is for folks who live in California, but it's a template for all of you who've been asking me, okay, how can I learn more about my state and local economy and government in a way that will, you know, sort of help transform our situation. Okay, so that's it for Money and Markets. Financial Musical Chairs, it intensifies. You know, this is going to go on for some time here, so hold on to your hat. I got a great question in Ask Catherine that I just wanted to address quickly, and let me just read to you what it was. Vice President Cheney is promoting himself as the poster boy for the next Republican presidential nomination in the 2012 election. I believe it is becoming more evident that VB Cheney is aligning himself with the Republican Party via the court of popular opinion, the media as the poster boy for best Republican presidential candidate in 2012. Is this possible, or is he just performing damage control for a very fragmented party? Good question. I don't know the answer, but let me give you a couple thoughts. Financing a presidential candidate is a very expensive proposition. The Obama campaign raised and spent almost $1 billion. So we're talking about the equivalent of financing a huge business. I mean, this is very big business. Now, Cheney has a very serious heart condition, and it is inconceivable to me that serious money would ever back somebody with that kind of heart condition. It's just not possible. The second thing is, one of the great rules in political campaigning is you never run a candidate with high negatives. And if you look at Hillary Clinton, one of her problems and the reason Obama got a lot of backing early was people were concerned she had high negatives. Cheney has high negatives. So the idea that somebody would put up serious money for someone with a heart condition with high negatives, I just can't fathom that that's possible. So I think it is an interesting question. What is Cheney up to? The answer is, I don't know. But I think there are possibly two possibilities. One, he's protecting the retreat of the Bush administration from Washington, because there's effort to bring indictments, et cetera. And so he's running. A good offense is the best defense. And so he's running the slash offense defense. The other is he's riding shotgun for the administration. There's a whole bunch of policies that Obama is continuing. It's difficult for the Democrats, given that Obama is switch-hitting his campaign positions, to defend them. It's a lot easier for them if Cheney is out there as the former vice president defending them. So that's two possibilities, but I think it's a good question. I think the chances that Cheney's promoting himself for the next Republican presidential nominee is highly, highly unlikely. So that's it for Ask Catherine. So we're up to take action. One of the most positive spots in the economy right now is community banks. Now, those of you who know me know I've been talking about community banks for a long time, because I think there's such an opportunity when we switch our money to a financial institution that really has an intimate relationship with its community and with its depositors. And what's interesting is now that, you know, throughout America we have thousands of small local banks, credit unions, savings banks that have not you know, engaged in derivatives. They've stuck to their basic business. They've been prudent. They have sound operations. And they're being rediscovered as people are just appalled with the headlines regarding some of what's been going on in the larger banks. But the other thing is I think people really want to know who they're doing business with. And so we're seeing trends all across the country of more and more people switching or trying to switch to local banks. And I'm getting, at Solari, we're getting more and more questions about how do I find who are the local banks, how do I switch. And so I thought, okay, well, let's do a Solari report on this. But this time, instead of me trying to handle the questions, I have to have real bankers doing it. So let me explain some of these real bankers who we've got on the call, because it's just a privilege to introduce them. Since 2006, I've banked at National Bank of Malvern, which is a community bank in Malvern, Pennsylvania, outside of Philadelphia, where I grew up. And the bank is owned and operated by the third, fourth, and fifth generation of one of the original founders. They're now the Willits and Shipp families, and they happen to be my cousins. So this is a point of disclosure. You're hearing my cousins. We're both descendants of my great-grandfather Willits, who was, among other things, a dairy, mushroom, and flower farmer in Westchester, Pennsylvania. He helped organize the Dairy Farmers Association in Pennsylvania and served as the Pennsylvania Secretary of Agriculture. And this is a bank with very deep roots in their community, and they're very kind to help us. I should say one of the reasons we bank at National Bank of Malvern is because the attention to the business and the quality of customer service is extraordinary, and that's my experience with many, many community banks. And it's for me, it's a real pleasure to do business with an institution that is so carefully managed and cares so much clearly about their community. So with that, it's just a great privilege to introduce you to the bank chairman, Lydia Bartholomew Willits, who we all call as Tommy by her nickname. Tommy, are you with us?
Yes, I am, Catherine. Thank you.
And her nephew and my somehow distant cousin, Vice President Bill Shipp. Bill, are you with us?
Hello, Catherine. Thank you so much.
Well, it's great to have you guys on. If you could first start us off and give us sort of a history of National Bank of Malvern.
Sure, Catherine. First of all, I want to thank you for inviting us. And more than anything, we're so happy that we are your bank, and we appreciate your banking with us.
Well, you have to let me tell you a story. I was banking at a bank here in Tennessee, and then I was banking. We opened the account with you, and finally our wonderful head of operations came to me and said, you know, can we just bank at National Bank of Malvern? They're wonderful.
Oh, great. Well, we are so proud to be a small bank that knows each of our customers as individuals, something that's been so lost by the large banks. Our bank was founded in 1884 by my great-grandfather, William Evans, and they were Quaker farmers. They located the bank in the middle of Malvern and at the corner of two dirt roads, because at that point it wasn't even a borough, but they located it there because of the main line out of Philadelphia, train tracks. So we are blessed to be a quarter block from the R5, so we can at any time jump on the R5. I am the fourth generation, and Bill Shipp, who's here tonight to help me, is the fifth generation, and my children are the fifth generation. This is our 125th year, and as you walk into our original building, which we were discussing earlier, that it was built as a bank, but also for apartments. In case the bank failed, they would be able to use the building for something, and they were so practical back then. And as you walk in our historic building, you see our original money with our bank's name on it hanging in the lobby.
You were issuing your own currency.
It was U.S. Treasury, yeah. Sent us money with our name on it, and it was our cashier's job to cut the money, which came in rolls, and sign each bill before they were actually put into circulation. And this is our popularity continues to be known as a safe, conservative bank that never even closed during the Depression. And we actually do very little advertising here at our bank, but customers come in from word of mouth, and they know our reputation, and we've been lucky enough to be very successful. But we don't want to be a big bank, and as my mother says, who's been on the board here for 60 years, let the big banks take care of the big guys, and we will take care of the small guys. And being closely held in our family, we don't declare dividends. We put all our earnings back into capital. So we are presently, with a $128 million asset bank, we're at 13.44% capital.
Wow.
And maybe some of your viewers don't know what that percentage means, but if you have a 10% capital bank, you are a very, very safe bank.
Right.
And we love our town. We're kind of the poster child for our town of Malvern, which is called Victorian Malvern. And we're very involved with many community things. And Jim Fuskas, who was with us last night, actually serves on the Malvern Business Association, and we're all very involved. And I'd have to say, if somebody asked me the question, what is the National Bank of Malvern all about, I'd have to say it's about community and giving back to our community. And it's also about relationships and giving the best customer service that we can possibly give. And it's also about our heritage and being conservative, and being a conservative bank, well-run, safe, and sound. So thank you.
Now, one thing I know, one thing that's very different at a bank like National Bank of Malvern is when you deal with a bank, you're dealing with the decision makers, where when you're dealing with a large bank, particularly now the decision has been drawn back and very centralized, and you have much more central control. So there's a really, I think for me, one of the big things is you're dealing with the decision makers.
That is absolutely true. We're all here on a daily basis. Actually, all the board members work at the bank, most of the board members, not all of them, I'm sorry. And we are right here. So when people call to ask a question, is financing possible? We're here to answer their questions.
Now, I know, one of the things I talk a lot about, both on the blog and with the subscribers, is issues related to securitization. And I know you don't, and I think this is true for a lot of community banks, you don't securitize any of your loans. So your mortgages stay on your balance sheet.
That's correct. This is Bill Schiff here. That is correct. We do not securitize our loans. We hold them on the books for their maturity, for the duration, and they're here with us. They're here to stay. So obviously our conservative underwriting standards that have to apply really do have
right.
to apply.
Right. So you know, you're living with – you know, it's a much more close connection with the customer.
It really is, Catherine, really is. I mean, I joined the bank shortly after 9/11. When things went out of control with the Patriot Act and with major, major moves in compliance that had to be addressed and laws and such. And I was prior was working with a Fortune 500 multi-billion dollar commercial finance company partnered with Fannie Mae. So I was used to the bureaucracies and compliance of commercial lending and banking. And here I go from that to a community bank where my grandmother's in her 90s and I'm trying to negotiate salary with a woman in her 90s while I've got
who's very frugal.
It's very frugal. A Quaker run, a Quaker family, and it was quite amazing an adjustment for me to see the transition from bureaucracy of a large institution to one of a small community bank, and what a surprise it was for me. It was absolutely an amazing thing, and one of the things that that I've been so upset about lately has been the Scrimmage-Bliley Act that was, back in the days that allowed banks to go into other avenues of business other than banking, and I think that's where we've gotten into a lot of problems with these larger banks. We don't do that. Smaller banks and community banks in general are regulated by much higher standards than some of these other larger institutions that may have entities that are largely unregulated. relative to what we are, what we are standing by.
Yeah, we saw that in the brokerage community. The smaller broker dealers were much more, when I had my Hamilton, you know, we were much more regulated than when I was at Dillon Rain on Wall Street.
Yeah. And, you know, we're a bank. We're a very unique community bank in that we're family-owned. And we are a dying breed. In fact, you know, community banks over the years have been whittled down to mergers and acquisitions. And the thought process was larger banks. Hey, let's merge. Let's grow.
Right.
Because the economies of scale gets us greater profitability. And I like to quote an article that I read in December of 2008 from Washington Monthly magazine. It's an article called Too Small to Fail. The whole behemoths of Wall Street stumble and fall. Humble local banks are doing just fine, thank you. Their surprising resilience holds a key lesson for 21st century global finance. And I think what they're attributing to is that community banks, we stay conservative. We focus in on the community. We focus the needs of local families, businesses, and farmers. And we don't look outside of our area to do a business. And we're very accommodating and personal. We have the ability as decision makers within ourselves to essentially structure things that make sense. And that, in many cases, saves the lives of families and individuals. And I have to quote an individual I know that wanted to borrow $1.5 million from us for a very high-end luxury home we knew he couldn't afford. We declined his application. He went to Wells Fargo for the loan. And unfortunately, he had a major heart attack and lost his ability to work, and therefore his home was under foreclosure. He desperately needed to do a short sale to get this home off of his back and get in something less stressful, because it was just his financial duress made him even more unhealthy. It took 6 months for Wells Fargo to do something that we could have done in 15 minutes, and that's
right.
What made sense was to do the short sale, get it through, and go on with things. And that's customer service. You saw customer service. We do give a friendly smile and a handshake in a relationship-oriented bank. But our customer service, the core customer service, comes from what we call customer services, creativity, flexibility, adaptability. We're local decision makers. We make our own decisions, and we consider character, family history, and you know, individuals' character as a major role in loan decisions. In fact, it's very difficult for me to get the board onto the financial decisions and based on financial ratios than it is individuals and how they, you know, who they are children of and what businesses that they've formed. But, you know, I mean, we definitely focus in on things in this community. I mean, and in light of, I mean, there's definitely been, a flight to quality, and I don't think you're going to find a better quality institution than a community bank these days. I think
now, one of the, you know, you really are relationship bankers,
mm-hmm.
and I find myself constantly trying to explain to people who've gotten used to being in a transaction relationship with the bank and not having a personal relationship, the importance of getting in and creating that relationship long before they need it. Because you can't help somebody you don't know, and you can't know them unless you've dealt with them for a long time.
That's correct. I mean, my advice to people has always been, in small businesses particularly, get out to know your, you know, find a community bank. Find a community bank that you know is good from your research, from referrals, from talking to friends, talking to other businesses in the area, and research their condition from maybe the website, some of the internet, ffiec.gov,
uh-huh.
has all the data on all the different financial institutions.
Now, the FDIC website has annual reports, correct?
It's actually the FFIEC.
Okay.
Which is a Federal Financial Institutional Examination Council. Now, I know what this is that there's all these different regulators and different institutions and banks
uh-huh.
and whatnot. And the FFIEC consolidates state committees, it consolidates the federal committees and the federal examination committees, credit unions. So all the banking and FDIC-insured institutions, whatever they are on that website. And you can generate, you can search for their financial history. You can run queries on how they rank compared to their peer groups, profitability-wise, if there is any formal compliance issues with them, agreements, formal agreements with the OCC, disciplinary actions and whatnot. You can find in that FFIEC, which is Frank, Indigo, Echo, Candle, so FFIEC.gov is a great website for people to do research on that.
And we should just mention OCC is the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, which is a part of Treasury that regulates banks.
Yes. I've been in bank every too long when I start speeding off acronyms like the regulators do to us. And it was say. But I think that...
Now, Brent, there's bank rating services, too.
That's correct.
That's correct.
And bankrate.com has some good resources you can use to research on banks. But the thing is, with any institution, you're never going to get the full picture on things. And every institution has something that is not public information. I don't have to disclose as an institution what my bond portfolio is relative to losses, what our MBS securities are, unless I'm a certain asset size or unless I have significant losses that are occurring in there. So I think you really have to, when you're looking at a financial institution, just do what you do with any other investment in any other institution, and that's look towards management. Look at who's running the bank and how long have they been employed with the bank, who's making the decisions. And I think that what we've seen lately has been, I think, an interdependence among banks that have brought some smaller banks down. In fact, I think in recently the FDIC took over Silverton Bank in Atlanta, Georgia, which was $4.1 billion in assets. It cost the FDIC $1.3 billion in their dwindling insurance fund. And already in 2009, the FDIC spent $5.3 billion in bank failures. There's only $13.6 billion left. We only have 39 banks. But what that did was that affected some of the other what's called correspondent banks with them, smaller banks that had relationships. In fact, that failure affected over 1,400 different banks and financial institutions. So that's a massive amount of.
Yeah, here in the South, it really scrambled a whole bunch of people in Tennessee.
Catherine, you mentioned your audience's love stories, and I have to tell a story about this small bank. Malvern actually went to public sewers quite a few years ago, and back when rates were 8%, the National Bank of Malvern gave out 4% loans, so our merchants, our wonderful merchants up and down the street, could hook up to sewers and borrow money at 4%. So that was so appreciated by the borough here in Malvern, and another way that we could give back as a bank.
Right, and imagine how hard it would be for a big bank to stretch and do that.
Very hard. That would be very hard. Yes.
It's funny because whenever I come there and I ask you, what's going on, you'll tell me five different things that you've done, you or someone else at the bank is doing in the community. It's incredible because it's everything is so interwoven between the small businesses who are your customers and you and what's really, it's such an intimate part of everything that's going on. And I think that's one of the reasons I think in this environment, community banks are so strong because if they're well managed, they're just such an integral part of what needs to get done every day in a community. You can't imagine them not being there.
It's an incredible contribution that community banks make. And did you know that community banks make nearly three times as many small business loans on a dollar-for-dollar basis as do large banks? That's data from the Federal Reserve.
Well, that's one of the things I talk a lot about at Solaria is the multiplier. And so if you deposit your money at a bank, which is doing a lot more small business loans, then there's a real multiplier in the community because you get more circulating.
Right. Yeah.
Well, I wanted to just mention the process of somebody switching. I know we talked, you just mentioned it, Bill, but I think it's so important to say who owns this, who governs it, who manages it. It's all about who the people are, and I think you're right, that's more important than the financials. But then the big thing is, okay, now I've gotten a recommendation from everybody in the community. I know I want to go meet this bank. What do I do? Do I call them? Do I just walk in? How do I start this? It's a little bit like dating. How do I start this relationship?
Well, I think the first question one needs to ask is, you know, what is it they need a bank for? You know, they want their money, put their money in an account that's an aggressive growth, internet-based institution. Do they need business services? You know, what does your banking behavior dictate that you're going to need? Most banks can provide, most community banks can provide levels of services that match with large multi-billion dollar banks, ACH, electronic banking, internet banking. Most community banks have gotten to that level. And so I think one of the things that we first...
And often when people are switching banks to a small community bank, they become unhappy with some aspect of their large bank. And we often say to them, what are you unhappy about? What is not working? Because maybe we're going to do the same thing and we don't want to disappoint you. So let's go through and see what we can do to assist you to make you happy with your bank.
That's correct. That's a very good point. And the other one of the other things too is it's very important to, once you do get to know the bank a little bit, to ask a copy of their fee schedules for everything, loans, deposit accounts, because on average, 40% of a bank's profit does come from those fees, and they're vastly different. I mean, some banks charge virtually no fees, which is what we really typically do. We have a different philosophy than other banks. Even some community banks are quite fee fairly heavily. And
but there's no reason a bank wouldn't be fully transparent about what their fee schedule is.
Absolutely. And
okay.
And the class I had, Stonier Graduate School of Banking, last summer, and the first thing within the capital planning was, customers do not shop fees. And so they're trying to push in higher fees, especially now. FDIC banks are charging, certain banks are charging FDIC insurance surcharge on all accounts. So your deposit account, you're going to pay some banks are going to pay a certain dollar fee every month for an FDIC surcharge.
It's funny because one of the things at various times when I've said to people, look, get your money, you know, if you want your local economy to grow, get your money out of the big bank and move to a much more grounded local bank. And the first thing they say is, well, you know, I travel a lot, and so, you know, I need an ATM card that'll work everywhere. And I say, well, you know, I bank at National Bank of Malvern, and my debit card works in New Zealand, Estonia, Sweden, London, Zurich, you know, and they're always stunned. And then they say, well, I need internet banking. I said, we have internet banking. And I think people don't realize how technology, you know, has become ubiquitous.
Absolutely.
It's not just at the big guys. One thing I'd love for you guys to talk a little bit about is what the changes have been now in FDIC insurance, because we've just had the increase affirmed, and it's so confusing.
Oh, relative to the amount of FDIC insurance coverage, you're saying. Okay, sure, sure. Well, the FDIC increased the insurance coverage. Historically, it was $100,000 of FDIC insurance coverage per individual that had their account within the bank. And recently, they've increased that amount to $250,000 per individual. And an individual, and we had, when it was this liquidity crisis and banks were failing left and right, we had a storm of customers come in and want FDIC insurance analysis done. But they were surprised, many were surprised to find out that if an individual has a bank account with us, they're now covered up to $250,000. And if they have a joint account with someone other than the one that they had, and individually, they're covered to another $250,000.
So a couple can do, how much could a couple do?
Each of them would be $250,000 individually and $250,000 in each account. So $500,000 up to $1 million per couple. That's a right. major amount. Now, if that's going to stay in place, I think that's not going to be forever. But IRAs and trust accounts, there's all different types of sub-nuances that the FDIC insures upon. Now, so if you have a family limited partnership, each beneficiary, which is called a qualified beneficiary, is covered for $250,000 too as well. So if you have a family trust, or if you have a life estate or some kind of trust set up for some beneficiaries, each of those beneficiaries qualified beneficiaries, which means a direct descendant, son, daughter, they have to be pretty closely held as covered up to $250,000 in addition to yourself.
Right. So if somebody wants to hold a fair amount of money in a bank, it really makes sense to sit down with their banker and work out what's possible.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. There's a lot more possible than there was a few years ago.
That's correct. And some banks have relationships with other banks where you can have up to $10 million in a bank, and they may farm out a portion of your deposit to another bank and try and maximize your FDIC coverage through a sharing process that goes on through some institutions.
Right. Yeah, we've seen that. Now, what's been happening with your deposits over the last 2 years?
Our deposits, Austin, have just, with this economy, they have escalated because people are leaving the large banks and coming to a small bank. September 28th, I remember in particular, we had 3.3 million new money walk in the door, and consistently,
that was
Dave Wachovia announced they were selling, and consistently, we've been running here at the National Bank of Malvern 200,000 to 500,000 new money per week, so we are very blessed to be on the radar of people that know we're a small, secure bank that cares about their people, and we're a safe bank more than anything because people have been running scared. So we have really lucked out with this economy.
Well, it's good to know that something's growing.
Exactly.
Okay, well, before we close, is there anything else, Bill or Tommy, that you wanted to mention?
We just wanted to say thank you, Catherine. We're honored to be asked to be on this seminar, and it's been exciting and wonderful to be part of it.
Well, I'll never forget one of the people on the Solari team when they switched their bank. They said, you have no idea what a big difference it makes to every time I do business or I write a check, I'm proud of where I bank. And so I want to thank you guys because I'm very proud of where I bank. And I know a lot of work has gone in for many generations to create an institution that's there for us now. And we really appreciate it. And I wish you would thank everybody also at the bank for me because I know other people will have to work hard because you guys stayed up late to do this.
Well, thank you. We appreciate it.
Yes, thank you very much, Catherine. We
thanks,
really
Bill.
Appreciate that. Absolutely.
Okay, for those of you in Pennsylvania, you if you get a chance, you have to go out to King and Warren Street in Malvern and see this beautiful little bank. It's very Quakerly. Anyway, and you can in the lobby, you can see a picture of the currency once upon a time that they issued. Okay, let's go to the movies. I really hope you got a chance to see Maxed Out. If you didn't, I encourage you to do it. There are a few things I wanted to point out. One is it's a documentary about the credit card business over the last 10 or 15 years and the explosion of credit card debt and the marketing and the efforts by the banks to literally entrap people into debt that they can't afford. And I'm just going to touch on a couple of highlights. One of the questions I get asked a lot is, who can I trust? And I wanted to mention that I think one of the best people in terms of describing what has happened in America with consumer debt and credit card debt and why Americans have become so indebted is Elizabeth Warren, who oddly enough is at the law school at Harvard University. And it's always, you always get this funny feeling of, here's this extraordinarily capable person doing great research on what's happening to America, and they're sitting in a university where the endowment is contributing mightily to the conditions that force people to go into debt and experience falling income. So you're always amazed at the contrast between the person and the work they're doing and the deeper real deal on the institution that's financing them. But regardless, there's a great two great scenes with interviewing of Warren that I wanted to point out. One is she had published work on her research into bankruptcy and bankruptcy statistics, and a senior executive from Citibank called her and asked her if she would give a seminar for the executives at Citibank about these issues. He was in the credit card area. And so she gave a presentation and explained how if they would just change their policies regarding the portion of their customers who were essentially very, very likely to go into bankruptcy if they lent to them, that they could cut their losses and that they could cut the number of bankruptcies by phenomenal amounts. And finally, after much discussion, someone in the back of the room says, well, you know, that's very interesting. But if we cut those people, that's where we make all of our money. And so essentially what she's describing, and it's very poignant because she does it very professionally, is that Citibank is making its money by driving people intentionally into bankruptcy. Later on, at a later point in the documentary from the same interview, she describes a judge forcing the banks to illuminate in their billings of various people going into bankruptcy how much of the money the people owe come from interest and fees and how much come from principal. And finally, they fess up that the vast majority of the money owed comes from fees and interest as opposed to principal. And throughout the story, what you see is the unbelievable fees and interest that can compound. And, you know, I've heard and seen situations where, you know, the fees and interest are just unbelievable. I'm sure you have, too. And part of this comes from the fact that we've literally seen an explosion in the financial industry as a sort of market share of the economy and the lobbying dollar in Washington. And we have gotten the usury laws literally beaten back or rescinded, and so now anything goes. And we're watching practices in this industry that would have made the mafia blush when I was growing up. So, you know, it's quite extraordinary. A third time when they interview Warren, which is a very important moment, and it ties back with what we were talking about in Money and Markets, she says, you know, I meet a lot of very smart people in our Congress, and she's been talking about the fact that debt is not the result of frivolity. Debt is the result of families really being driven to the edge in having to pay for basics. You know, so a lot of times it's health care, but just the basic needs of life are driving people over the edge, and they're turning to debt. This is not frivolity. It's not people being, you know, bad behavior. This is people trying to struggle and deal with healthcare problems or other sort of very basic things as income falls and the purchasing power of families falls. And so she said, you know, I run into some very smart people, and I say to them, what is the plan here? What's going to happen when the bills come due? What are the great thinkers thinking about how we're going to deal with this? And she says, all I get is sort of blank stares. And then she says, what's the exit plan? I don't know. Now, you know, I go back to the Dylan Reed story that I wrote and published. It's up. You can link to it from my homepage. In the 90s, what I was doing was basically I and a group of people were saying to policymakers, look, we've got to take extraordinary steps to re-engineer skills so that people can keep their incomes up and get their debt down. And a decision was made, no, let's take debt up, both government debt, state and local government debt, federal debt, consumer debt. Let's take debt up and let's not deal with the changes that need to happen or the skills or income. In fact, let's really cut the flow of equity capital to small business. As a result, what you have are you have rising consumer debts, falling income, and now, as the population ages, an explosion in liabilities for Medicare, Medicaid, Social Security, which now that we've liquidated so much savings of the general population, those things are essential for survival. The thing, when you combine what Bernanke is saying this week about having to cut back entitlements with what Warren is saying about what's the end game with the story of Dylan Reed and the debate that went on in Washington during the 90s, literally what you're seeing is you're seeing, you know, the real left behind story. For those of you who may know, there was a very popular series of books called Left Behind that sort of caught on in the, among the Christian community, and it was about the, a fictional account of the rapture. But essentially what we saw in the 90s was a series of decisions to pull capital out of the country and explode debt, including consumer debt, and literally what we've seen is the rug pulled out from under people before they knew it was happening, and they've been, from a financial standpoint, left behind. So, so it is what it is, and the question is now, what are we going to do about it? Because our help is not going to come from Washington. There's a lot that can be done. Things are far from hopeless, but part of dealing with it is kind of is seeing it the way it really is. You know, you've always heard me talk about my pastor in Washington. He used to say, if we can face it, God can fix it. But there's a lot of benefit from facing it and moving on. There are two quick things I wanted to also mention. There's a back in the Maxed Out DVD. There's a, it's not in the the regular documentary, but it's sort of an outtake in the special feature from Dave Ramsey, who is a well-known talk show host, particularly here in Tennessee, and does a lot of programs around the country on debt reduction. And Dave Ramsey is somebody I have a lot of respect for, a lot of admiration, and one of the reasons I really like him, as a young person in his 20s, he got made a lot of money, got himself over-leveraged, got in real trouble, lost everything, and had to come back. And he learned very young the dangers of debt. And his whole approach is really take personal responsibility and get yourself out of debt. And one of the reasons I like about it is it doesn't matter, you know, what the banks did. It doesn't matter what the government did. It doesn't matter what the large institutions did. Whatever the situation is what it is. And the fastest way to solve a problem is to take complete responsibility for it, whether it's our fault or not. And that's where we get our power. And I think Dave Ramsey does a great job of helping people sort of gather their power in a bad situation and really take action. So Ramsey's somebody who I think, you know, if you're interested in debt reduction, Ramsey's somebody who you might find interesting. The second, the other thing I wanted to mention is there's a great shot in Maxed Out of Susie Orman talking very frenetically on her TV show about the importance of your FICO score, and then they flash a comment on the screen that says she has a deal with the parent company of FICO, you know, clearly intimating here's somebody who's not disclosing conflicts of interest. As I said in my blog post, Susie Orman is someone I never recommend, and in one sense that's unfortunate because if you look at her books, she has a lot of good technical information. They're well written. You know, there are nuggets in there. The problem is that basically you're getting a lot of information that helps you get over the fact that you or your family or someone's got, you know, been burnt. And then they channel you right back into the same system that burnt you. In other words, you never get to see the bigger picture of the economic warfare that's going on, and before you know it, you're channeled back into the same system that burnt you before. And I don't know how to recommend Orman without, you know, I don't know how to help you sort through the nuggets of what's worth it and the danger of getting channeled right back into the same old, same old. And so so I never recommend Orman because, essentially you're being encouraged to go back into the same institutions that just caused the last problem, not just in your personal pocketbook or your personal portfolio, but in your government as well. So, and I think there's nothing more important than who you do business with, who you transact with. If you do business with institutions which really are grounded in relationships with real people and real businesses, your money can have an absolutely very positive effect. The more of us who do it, the more it compounds and grows. And we can really start to shift a lot of money out of the very unhealthy, dangerous, and harmful part of the economy into a much healthier, much more grounded, real wealth-building part of the economy. So, and it's essential that we all do it. And I started to do it just as as someone who was looking for real solutions. And after many years of doing it, I woke up one day and I said, this is great. I'm doing business with all ethical people and people I like and people I'm proud of. And it's really, it's really changed the whole energy of my life. And, it turned out to be much more gratifying than I ever dreamed when I started. So your money counts, and you need to know where your money is going and who it's supporting and how it multiplies out. So with that, that's our Let's Go to the Movies for tonight. I really encourage you, if you haven't seen Maxed Out, it's a great documentary, very well done. And so that's it. Coming up in June, next week, Precious Metals Update, our movie is the wonderful comedy Other People's Money with Danny DeVito. I've seen it so many times in anticipation of next week. I just watched it again. I can't stop playing. It's a great movie, and we're going to talk about the very heart of, as a lot of us leave the last economy, where the opportunity is transformation. And one of the critical questions we're all going to have to get into the trenches and resolve is, how do we combine the sort of hot money coming back in with the local money? How do we bring these different constituencies together in a positive way? And then June 18th, California budget crisis. Yikes, what can I do? Again, we'll be focused on California, but I'm hoping to create a little bit of a template that everybody can use in our state, because the state and municipal squeeze is happening no matter where you are, so it's something we all want to think about. Okay, that's it for this evening. Please remember, don't worry about whether or not there is a conspiracy. If you're not in one, then you need to start one. Good night and good luck.